You are listening to BensTorah.com.
Alcohol, it's one of my favorite topics. And there's a story, most of us, or many of us, growing up, we went to shul in the morning, and after davening, so, you know, all the yidden used to sit down, and there's a brumfen, there was some kichel, and some herring, and they used to drink. And this was a common, you know, was yahrzeit, yes, no yahrzeit, didn't make a difference. This was a morning practice. And there was one yid, you know, some of them drank vodka, some of them drank scotch, not single malt, they invented single malt at that time yet. They drank the blendeds in those days. And some of them used to drink Sechsundneunziger. Anyone know what Sechsundneunziger is? Yeah, that's the highest if you distill alcohol, the highest you can get to is 96%. There are some methods today that can actually go higher than that. So that's traditionally what the highest was. And one yid, you know, wasn't feeling well, went to the doctor. And comes to the doctor, and the doctor, after a thorough examination, says to him, he says, you know, you have water on the lungs. So he says, I always knew the 4% would get to me. So that's the relationship we have with alcohol. But sometimes it's a good relationship, sometimes it can be not such a good relationship. But more specifically, conscience-wise, alcohol, and I'd like to speak a little bit about alcohol post-Pesach. Most of us, probably on the advice of Rabbanim, have thought, you know, Lag BaOmer is sort of the, you know, how much level of Pesach, that's the time that you have to be concerned about. Once Lag BaOmer comes, you know, no longer need to be concerned. Whether that's accurate for alcohol or not is something we'll perhaps touch upon. And maybe at the end, if you have a moment or two, we'll talk about alcohol the year round. So what is alcohol? There is no such thing as an alcohol pond where alcohol just comes out from the ground. So what is alcohol? Alcohol is a fermentation where you ferment sugar, and the sugar converts through the fermentation into two products. One is alcohol, and there's a byproduct, which is CO2, carbon dioxide. Now, interestingly, you know, this was a question, one of the primary sources historically for carbon dioxide to make things like seltzer was from beer, because after you ferment beer, you had CO2. Is that an issue for Pesach? Beer, of course, not for Pesach. Is that an issue? That's not something we'll get into right now. Today, it's really not an issue because CO2 is made from much more effective means than by fermentation of beer. So that's not relevant so much. So this is what alcohol is. Now, whoops. Okay. What was the source of alcohol in the world? The source of alcohol was grapes, because that's historically that people made wine. Why? Because it almost happens almost naturally by itself. How is that? You start with grapes, you start with the harvest, you crush those grapes, the grapes give off grape juice. What is grape juice filled with? It's filled with sugar. Then, interestingly, the peels of the grapes have yeast growing on them. So you have all the elements right there. You have the sugar, you have the yeast, and if you leave it under the right conditions, it will convert into alcohol. And then you press that, you age that, and then you have your bottle of wine. So that's basically the way it was. Of course, wine from grapes doesn't really present any issues for Pesach. Yes, there are some wines which are not crushed on Pesach. Why? Sometimes they're using sweetness, such as corn. Sometimes they're using flavors, sangria, are examples of wines which are not crushed on Pesach. But in terms of how much other level of Pesach, it's grape. The primary source is grape. It's really not an issue for Pesach. Now, if you want to take that further, and you want to take that wine, which will ferment up to about 14% approximately, give or take, the reason it stops after about 14% is either all of the sugar in the juice has been converted into alcohol, or because the, you know, alcohol is an antiseptic, it will actually kill the yeast that it came from. So about 14%, sometimes they'll get up to 16%, 17%. Wine yeasts are very sturdy, whereas beer yeasts are not as sturdy. Beer yeasts will only go about 7 or 8%, and then they'll stop. Wine will go up to about 14%, 15%. But everybody knows that the boiling temperature, freezing temperature of alcohol is not like water. Water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Not so the case, or 100, zero, if you're Celsius, if you use that system. Now, alcohol, we know we can put a bottle of vodka in the freezer, it doesn't freeze. Why? Because the freezing point is lower than zero. And as well, the boiling point is also lower. So there's a distillation process which essentially is cooking. You're cooking this 14%, let's say, wine. You cook it up, and what happens is before the wine or the other elements in the wine start to boil, the alcohol already starts to boil. And the alcohol rises up, turns into a vapor, and then you capture that, and you sort of take it to the side. That's how you make a higher level of alcohol. And then the result product would be something like cognac or brandy, which you take in your grape wine. It had 14%. You can take it up to, you know, much higher than that. You can take it up to 70% or maybe even higher than that. You don't want to go too high, because if you go too high, you're going to end up with a neutral spirit. You can end up with just plain alcohol, which has no flavor. It doesn't have any of the flavor components left over from the wine. So you don't want to take it up too high, otherwise you end up with vodka, which can be made from a variety of sources. We'll get to that. So this is what distillation is. Now, another example of a sugar which is turned into alcohol is rum. Rum is made from sugar. It can be made from molasses, which is, if you refine sugar, a byproduct is molasses. So simply, you take that, you put that into a fermentation tank with yeast, you distill it, and you end up with the product of rum. Of course, rum, of course, that doesn't present the problem for Pesach. Not to hold it on Pesach, I wouldn't drink it on Pesach without a Pesach hashgacha, because there are, you know, issues of kelim, there could be issues of equipment. If it's stored, if it's aged in barrels that have been used for chametz, that could be an issue. The yeast itself could be an issue. So this is an example of something which is made directly from sugar into the alcohol. That's an example of rum. Somebody, you know, south of the border, not the border without the wall. Yeah. South of the border, there's a plant which is called agave. Now, agave is this sweet fruit, very starchy fruit. And what they do with that fruit is they roast it. because the starches have to be broken down. Remember, you don't need starch to make, you can't make from starch alcohol, you need sugar. So they roast it, that breaks down the sugars, then you end up with a sugar syrup, an agave syrup, which is actually sold as a sweetener, you may see it in stores occasionally, and that product, again, is distilled, it's fermented, distilled. Tequila is something which could be kosher with Pesach as well. But again, it requires the Pesach Hashgacha because of certain processing or additives that may be added to it. There are some tequilas which have been made for Pesach, not all necessarily with full supervision as the OU would require, but we've done some tequila, not so much recently. But this is essentially, this is what happens with alcohol. Now when you deal with grains, everybody knows about grain because that's what you make whiskey from, that's what you make scotch and bourbon and things like that. So again, what are you starting with the grain? The grain is full of starch. But you need to extract the starches and break them down into sugar. So what you do is you take the grains, you mill them, you make them into a flour, then you put it into a mash tank. A mash tank is a cooking process where they actually add things like enzymes. And again, the enzymes have to be kosher, but what you're doing is you break it down, you're turning it into sugar. In Poland, they traditionally made vodka from potatoes. Again, very high starch content vegetable. You make that into a sugar before, and then essentially the process is the same. But this is essentially how all alcoholic, high alcohol products would be made. As far as halacha is concerned, we're familiar that a person who leaves, the Smag actually puts it very neatly, if a person leaves chametz in his rishus, and he leaves it over Pesach, he didn't eat it. He's over on two lavim in the Torah, there's Bal Yirah and Bal Yimatzeh. You're not allowed to own chametz, you're not allowed to maintain chametz in your possession, or in your home. And if a person does that, so that chametz becomes forbidden. And it says, chametz shal shavah of a Pesach v'shal chanach paskins, asu bahana, that becomes asu bahana. You cannot even, not just eat that chametz, you cannot even benefit from that chametz. And this is, interestingly, afilu yinichat shayge goyenis. That's even if it was done accidentally. Or even, let me give an example of a shayla that the Steichemed talks about. Steichemed has a question as follows. There was a woman who had lost her husband. Passed away. He was a liquor merchant, as so many Jews in Europe earned their panasa, being, and she didn't know how much about Pesach. She didn't know much about the business either. And here, she didn't have children. And here, she did not sell the chametz before Pesach. And here, she has a substantial inventory of alcohol. And now, it's after Pesach. The chametz was not sold. She stands to lose her entire panasa. What do you do for such a woman? So the Snechemet actually sent the shayla to the Malbim. And the Malbim, using a variety of kulas, which we'll discuss briefly, he wanted to be lenient for her in that circumstance. The Snechemet actually argued back. He couldn't get, the Malbim changed Rabbanus a lot. He went from Rabbanus to Rabbanus to Rabbanus, and apparently when he had written him back, there was no forwarding address for that. So the communication ended there, so he couldn't get hold of the Malbim anymore. Snechemet argued on him, but the Malbim wanted, so what are the basis? It's an interesting thing about this Knast Rabbanus. Chazal said, you keep chametz on Pesach, you're over left, so after that, it's forbidden. Even if it was an accident, even if it was beyond, completely beyond your control, it's awesome. But take it a step further. Let's say a guy who owns a whiskey company, he is Jewish. He kept his chametz. He doesn't know anything about chametz, he doesn't know anything about Pesach. And I went out and I bought a bottle of schnapps. And he did the Aveira. I didn't do the Aveira. I have a problem. That's how far this goes. That's how far this kness goes. So is there room to be lenient? And you do find, actually, many people who don't want to sell chametz, they don't want to sell crackers or bread for Pesach. Because they, to rely on the mechiras chametz they don't want. But very often people do sell schnapps. Because it's a big investment. People have bottles that are worth, worth $1,000 sometimes. So, what do you mean? You give it away. So people do sell. Why is there a reason? Is there a reason to be lenient for schnapps more so than other things? So there is actually, this is a concept, there's a sugya in brachas that talks about what bracha you make on something extracted from something else. You have a fruit, and you extract something, let's say honey, from fruit. What bracha? Does it maintain the original bracha of the fruit where it creates, or does it take on a new bracha? So the Chazal say that it's a new bracha, it's a shahapa. Why? Because that is considered zeya. We consider it like vapor. Because what comes out of the fruit is not the original fruit, it's like the vapor of the fruit that came out. That wants it to be applied in other circumstances. Let's say, and this is what the Shulchan Aruch talks about, it's a Tshuvas HaRivash, which talks about the following. There was a medicine, it's called Agua Ardanti. I can't ask you what that translates to, but it was some kind of a refuah which was alcohol, based on alcohol. Shalavdi kachav, it was made from grapes, which were made from wine, which was not kosher wine. So the Shulchan Aruch says, Asr b'hanah k'yayin atzma. Despite the fact that this is a derivative of the wine, it still is asr. And as an example, there is this relevant, some people have this thought, I'll buy cognac. Cognac is a very popular drink, in France especially. It's a sometimes very expensive drink, and it's made from non-kosher wine. And some people say, it's not the wine itself. It's not even the same bracha, right? If you make a berkah gofen, that's only on the wine. If you have cognac, if you have brandy, kosher assuming, you make a shahakah, you don't make the same bracha. So therefore, maybe, as far as these surim, so there was this question, but the Shulchan Aruch says it does not remove the iser that exists for stam yayin. However, there was a sefer Mishnah Siakim, was actually the Karlina Rav, not a chassid, but the Karlina Rav was before the Chassidim came to Karlin. The Mishnah Siakim argued that that was said for yayin, which was also. But other types of isurim, something like chametz, because you go through a distillation process, What are you doing? You're taking this chametz, this liquid which has chametz in it, and what you're doing is you're cooking it up and you're taking out a vapor. He says, that's Zeyah Balma. He says, the Isser, with Yayin perhaps, because Yayin is a special chumra, that even if you to degrade the wine, it still remains also because it's Avodah Zarah. That's the primary source for the Isser of Yayin, is Avodah Zarah. But that shouldn't be the case with other types of Isser. So for other types of Isser, Mishnah Siyakov argued, and therefore chametz, he said also, the Schnatz, which is derived from chametz, is Zeyah Balma. That's the term he used, it's vapor, and therefore it should not remain also. So that was one leniency. There's actually another leniency in the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which is written by the Balatanya. There's a Haggah from his brother, the Mariel, I think his name is Yehuda Lake. And there's a Haggah there, he argues like this. In order for something to be Balyurab Balyamotze, it has to be a Shir, right? It has to have a Shir. You're not, if you have a Pirurim Balma, if you have that's a crumbs, you're not over Balyurab Balyamotze for having crumbs that you didn't clean out. I know we all try to clean our homes very carefully for Pesach, but if you have small crumbs left over, not a Balyurab Balyamotze question. Now, he says like this. And why is that? Because you would have to eat it within the Shir, the amount of time allotted for eating, in order to be over to be a Mechulik curse. He says, Schnapps is never, you wouldn't drink it that way. Because schnapps is harif, it's sharp. People drink wine, people don't drink schnapps, they sip schnapps. Since you only sip it, you're only drinking it at intervals. So therefore, it's not something which the Isser, Balyurab Balyamotze, would apply to that. So therefore, he doesn't say this as a lachatchila, he says this as a leniency, for example, and this is what the Malbim actually used, to be mapped for that woman, that almana, who had all the schnapps, he wanted to use this with Tzimufim, with other things together, to try to be lenient in her specific situation. Now, how does this apply to us? And one of the questions that comes up, and there was actually, I'll call it the Bourbon Bruja, that took place about 10 years ago in the world of kashrus. What happened was, there's a company which is based in New Orleans, in Kentucky, called Sazerac. It's owned by a Jew. And they're one of the biggest bourbon makers in the world. They make a whole number of different bourbons. Now the question was, this Jew was not a religious Jew, and he did not make a Mechiras Chametz, and bourbon oftentimes is aged for 3, 5, 10 years. And the question is it permitted to buy the schnapps? Because if you're buying these bourbons, which come from this company, inevitably you're buying something, a whiskey, which was around on Pesach, maybe multiple Pesachs, is there for 3, 5, 6, whatever it is, years. So the question was, this was debated. Bourbon, by definition, it has a certain flavor. I don't know if anybody who drinks bourbon does or doesn't, but it has a certain unique flavor to it. Why is that? It's mandated by law to be at least 51% corn. Sometimes much more than that, sometimes 60, 70% corn. Now, because it's mostly corn, and corn, of course, is kidneys, but it's not chametz, is that a reason to be makel that we should be able to be lenient? And actually, the Shulchan Aruch seems to indicate, and the Mishnah Berurah seems to pasken, that when it comes to chametz, sh'omer lev ha-pesach, we can be lenient if you have a rov, if you have a majority, which is not chametz. So it should seem to be a slam dunk, that in this case, despite the fact that this guy didn't sell his chametz, and this is bourbon, and when they make it, they mix all the things together. So if it was around for this Pesach, last Pesach, previous Pesach, it always had a majority of non-chametz, so it should be mutter. However, others argued, and Rishabelsky argued that it should not be considered mutter. And the reason is, when would you say that it's batel b'roiv? It's based on a shach. That is said when you have min b'mima, when you have like objects which are mixed together, which are not really imparting flavor one to the other. Then you would say that you can consider look at the majority. However, if something is imparting flavor, then you need shishin, what's called min b'she'en b'mima, when you have this. So he said like this, he says, here you have bourbon, which is mostly corn, but you also have the rye, you also have the wheat, and they're unlike the corn, and they impart different flavors, so therefore it should not be batel. This was a big discussion. Again, there could be makom to be mekel. In terms of practical, today, what's actually happened in the world of liquor, as so many industries have, is there's been consolidation, mergers and acquisitions, and what you have are these tremendous companies, $70-80 billion companies, that have taken over brand after brand after brand after brand. Now, those companies are typically publicly traded, and they're not Jewish owned. Yes, I know that people have argued about there's a vice president and there's a CEO and there's a this, whether that impacts the status of the Jewish ownership is not so simple. So let's say take Diageo. Diageo is the largest liquor company in the world, and they have things like Crown Royal, which happens to be Crown altogether. Crown Royal is a corn-based product, but they have Black Label, Johnny Walker products. They have Smirnoff is actually a corn product. J&B, that Bullet, bourbon. So because these are in the hands of non-Jews, or at least publicly traded companies, which it's really hard to say that that's a Jewish-owned company or a Jewish-managed company, unless really the top brass of the company are Jewish. So these are less of an issue. This is really an issue. There are distributors. That's one of the things. Distributors. You have some Jews who are distributors, and they do hold on to the product for a time. And what's unique about liquor is that you go to ShopRite or supermarket of your choice. They move product very quickly. It sort of defies logic. You think you come into a supermarket and you see a box of Cheerios. Was that box of Cheerios, maybe it was in the back of the shelf, was it there 3 weeks ago? No. The turnover in a supermarket is very, very quick. That's what they're in business to do, is to sell product, to move product. And they do move product quickly. Not so much by liquor. Liquor has a long shelf life. You can keep it, especially it's like a liquor store. A liquor store will buy specials, a certain, and he'll put it away, cases of product, he'll put it away. Sometimes it'll be the rare, expensive schnapps, they'll put it away for 5 years, 10 years, until they've got someone who's crazy enough to spend that kind of money on a bottle. So. The argument of the whole slagbomber, I can close my eyes, may not necessarily apply. How to what extent we can be Mavara, we can, it's also hard. The number two company is Pernod Ricard. It's about a $40 billion company. But you know, the Lavashim, the Srigal, and Absolute Vodka, and things like that, Jameson. So these are our products. Again, it's in the hands of Goyim and the same Mr. Beam Santori, which is about a $30 billion company, also a big liquor company. As far as Jewish companies, there is a company called Heaven Hill Brands, which is owned by the Shapiro family. They've been making Mechir for the last 20 years. The local Chabad in Louisville, Kentucky has been making Mechir for them for the last 20 years, and their product should not be an issue. It's like I mentioned before, Sazerac, which makes a whole variety of bourbons, does not make Mechir. And again, so that really leads into the question for bourbon, of whether it's Bottle Barayv, and or whether it is, or whether you need Chishim, and that's that discussion that we have.
Will you see the name Sazerac on the bottle?
No, there's a list that's been published. I'm not a big fan of the list, but there is a list, if you want, that the Sake has such a list, and the CRC in Chicago has such a list, of all the brands that this company sells. But here's a few. But you can look it up on the web, you can see the brands.
You are listening to BenStower.com.
No. So that leads into, there's a lot of discussion about supermarkets, like our ShopRites, which are owned by Jews. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, and so everyone agrees with him, but he says that in the fact that he opens and keeps the business running on Pesach, which seems to contradict the whole Mechira. What? That's also, Rav Moshe says that the sale is a sale. If it's a bona fide legal sale, the fact that he violates the sale affects perhaps the product that he sells on Pesach, but it doesn't affect, you know, it doesn't negate the whole sale altogether. So if the sale is still a valid sale, so it may not, you know, when he's stealing from the guy the box of Cheerios to sell it to the customer, perhaps it invalidates the sale for that particular box of Cheerios. But does it invalidate the entire sale? He argues that it doesn't invalidate the sale. What's actually a larger problem is what they bring in on Pesach. Because a mechira can help you for what he owned before Pesach. What he brings in on Pesach is of course, it doesn't help. Again, there's I don't know if you noticed, there's a big discussion about a beer distributor.
Not beer.
Right, he's the largest beer distributor.
Sold it to the guy.
Right, so he sold it to the guy, so then the business is run and operated by a guy. So that's the preferred method, and that's used for a lot of supermarkets and you know, in these types of situations as well. As far as, you know, liquor all year, I don't want to finish up because we're very covered, needs to come and speak. You know, there are products that, you know, flavored vodkas, rums, liqueurs, which are sweetened, you know, invariably need a hatcher. Brandy, of course, needs a hatcher because of the wine. Beer, which is flavored, needs a hatcher. But those things, typically, without the flavors, people generally rely on, irrespective of the pace. Of course, the big question is the Scotch, Irish, and Canadian whiskies, which may be aged in casks, which are used previously for wine. And that's a discussion. Just a second, if you don't mind. This is a tshuva from Ramesha. It's actually one of my favorite tshuvas from Ramesha, because not so much because of the halacha that he discusses, but he speaks about blended whiskey which had wine mixed into it, and he says that wine is bottle b'shesh. That's a concept in Gemara. So Shachar passes that. Since it's bottle b'shesh, even if they blend in some wine, so Ramesha says like this. He says personally, he says, I'm meant to be machmer. I don't. You know, there are poskim saying Yichishim. He says, I'm machmer. He says, except when I come into shul and there's a kiddush and they mechavit me to drink. He says, then. You know, he says, then of course, I won't be machmer, you know, in the face of the other people, which is sort of, you know, counterintuitive of our thoughts about chumrah. Chumrah, what's the purpose of the chumrah if it doesn't stand up the next guy? So Ramesh had obviously a different view of that. He's saying that, and so he's mekel in that respect. There's another halacha, which is the Shulchan Aruch asks, is that when wine is stored in a cask, it only asks for the klipa, which means it's only a tiny amount of wine which goes in, which then would ask for only for the klipa of the liquor, let's say the whiskey, which is stored in it afterwards. The shach is machmer. But again, these are the two, you know, primary issues, where one can be maker or machmer when it comes to, you know, the sherry cask aged whiskeys and the things like that. So I would say like this, you know, everybody walks out, you know, whenever I say this, everybody walks out and says whatever they're going to do, whatever they're going to do. Is there makom lahakel? Absolutely. Would I be critical of somebody who drinks schnapps products which are stored in wine casks? I don't think one can be critical of them. They have a halachic basis for doing so. Is there room to be machmer? Yes, there is a room to be machmer also, and to buy products with a hechsher, or where one knows that sherry port casks have been used to store. It's not always easily to detect that just from a website or from a label, certainly. Just to give you an example, special reason to be machmer that people are not aware of. What type of casks do they use?
Oak.
Yes, they use oak, but they use oak from bourbon. That's not the problem. Our problem is the wine. What type of wine? They're not using sherry, port, Madeira, Marsala, Malaga. Why? Because those are fortified wines. Wine, we said, stops at about 14%, right? These are 20%, approximately, 18, 19, 20. Why? Because they add alcohol to the wine. That's what sherry is. It's a fortified wine. That may be the reason why, maybe all of these halachas, you know, that's a reason to be machmer, because all the issues of stam yayin, which are their kulas, may not apply if they're using a fortified wine, which is not just wine. It's wine and alcohol. And alcohol may be more chumer than just the wine by itself. So again, like I said, there's reason to be machmer, but at the same time, I think the people who want to be mekel have what to rely on. Yeah, thank you.
So brandy, I had a kosher case of brandy. Now, I checked the label, it didn't say like it was only for starch, but it's made from corn, wouldn't that be something?
Brandy is made from fruits. Brandy is made from fruits. So brandy would probably be made from wine. Wine or some brandy or sugar. It's not a...
Okay,
well,
one question.
Yeah.
I got an email that said that the duty-free shop in Eretz Israel Airport did not sell the chametz. The one near the boarding area did.
This has been an ongoing issue. The duty-free has a lot of Jews, not just in Israel, but all over the world. A lot of Jews are in that business. and it's sort of like a business by itself. They deal directly with the manufacturers. I don't know. I know that a lot of people are very concerned about what happens in Tel Aviv. I don't, like I said, it's one of those things that I don't know that if you wait 6 weeks or even 6 months that they've depleted their inventory. Sorry.
Subject I'm going to talk about what's known as lab-grown meat. So what's lab-grown meat? So instead of having a herd of cattle out in the fields, you bring the herd of cattle into the lab, right? No, you don't. That's a joke. So what they do is they isolate a number of cells, meat cells, from a piece of meat or from an animal, and then they put the cells into a machine called a bioreactor, and then they introduce into the bioreactor other ingredients, protein and the like, which then activate the cells to grow and to multiply. And eventually it turns into a piece of meat. That's really in a nutshell. But obviously, to pass a shiny like this, it's necessary to have all the facts and all the details of how the bioreactor works and how the cells multiply and how it's been isolated and so on and so forth. That's not something we're going to do today. But there is actually, on this particular subject, a fascinating goyim that's brought down in the Ksav Kabbalah in Parsha Shoftim. And the goyim explains the Gemara. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, in Daf Zayin, Omer Reb Shmuel ben Nachmani, Omer Reb Yonason, Kol Dayin Shedon Din Emes Lamitoi, Mash Reshin Bi Yisrael. Any Dayin who paskins a Din, Emes Lamitoi, so you have a Beis Din, a Dayonim, and they're sitting there, and the two Bali Din who are standing in front of them, and they're arguing, and each one tells his version of a story. The Gemara says that if he paskins Emes Lamitoi Shal Torah, it's Mash Reshin Bi Yisrael. It causes the Shechina to come down to Klal Yisrael. And the Goyen asks about the repetition over here in the Gemara. Emes la'amitoi shel Torah. Why is the Gemara being repetitious and telling us this word emes twice? So the Goyen explains something which is so important in every Shiloh, which every rabbi has to pass in. And when the Gemara does say it only over here in for a Dayan, it's relevant to all of us, in you and other Shilohs. The Goyen says as follows. Whenever you pass in a Shiloh, there's two types of emes that you need to clarify. The first emes is, you need to know which of these two Bali Din are telling the truth, if any of them are telling the truth, either of them. Which one is distorting the story? And you need to get to the bottom of it and understand exactly what really happened, the emes. That's the first emes you need to understand. The second emes, once you've clarified the facts, you need to understand also the emes, what the halacha is. And once you have both of these two aspects of emes, then you can say, and as I said, the same is true when it comes to shaylos and kashas, and the same is true in all the shaylos. It's imperative first to understand the facts thoroughly, and only then can we embark on understanding the halacha. So here in the case of the lab-grown meat, it's imperative to understand how it works before the paskin can actually pass in the shaylos. This lab-grown meat is also known as clean meat. The reason it's called clean meat is simply to give us the impression that natural meat is not clean. But don't worry about it, it's just an advertising gimmick. There's nothing cleaner about that meat than the meat that we have. So, I don't intend now to actually go and explain the psak halacha on the lab-grown meat. But what I do want to do is simply introduce the sugyas which are dealt with, which deal with this shayla. And the first one which the Poskim speak about is a Gemara in Sanhedrin Nun Tes. And the Gemara tells a story as follows. The Gemara starts like this. Omar Rabbi Yehuda Omar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda Omar Rav said, Odom HaRishon Lo Yehuta Lo Yboso Lachmir. Odom HaRishon was not allowed to eat meat. He did not have a heifer to eat meat. Yosef Lochem Yiyeh Lo Ochlo V'Lochol Chayas Ha'oretz. It says in the Pasuk, V'Lochol Chayas Ha'oretz V'Lo Chayas Ha'oretz Lochem. So the Gemara says, it's a drosha. And we understand the Pasuk infers it. You cannot eat Chayas Ha'oretz. וכשבואו בני נויח, הייתי להם, and when בני נויח came, then it became mutter, שנאמר, כי ירק עשב נוסעתי לכם, as cold. Then later in the Gemara, asks a kasha, and the Gemara says, מייסבי, הויו רבי יהודה בן תמר אומר, רבי יהודה בן תמר used to say, Odom HaRishon, מייסב בגן עדן הויו. The Gemara goes and describes exactly the circumstances of Odom HaRishon's existence in Gan Eden. He was sitting in Gan Eden. והויו מלאכי השורס, סוילין לוי בוסו, and the מלאכי השורס would roast meat for him, and they would filter wine for him. He sits by Nochosh, and the Nochosh saw what covet he had, when his kind of boy, he was jealous. So the Gemara says, here we see that Odom HaRishon ate meat. So how could you say before that Odom HaRishon wasn't allowed to eat meat? The Gemara says, no, that was different. The meat that the Malachim were roasting, were grilling for Odom HaRishon, wasn't the regular meat that you would take by slaughtering a behemoth, but it was meat which came min HaShomayim. So then the Gemara says, "Mi ike boso hayoyed min hashomayim? Is there such a thing as boso which comes from Shomayim?" So the Gemara says, "In here there is. Ki hod Rav Shimon ben Chalafta. We have a story. Rav Shimon ben Chalafta have a ko'ozil beruncha. Rav Shimon ben Chalafta was traveling. Hoku boy hanach ayir boso, and he came across two lions. The have konahama la'apei. and that they were roaring in his face. Rashi says they wanted to eat him, or hungry. Omar, so he did what a Yid does when he's in such a situation, and he davened. And he said, Akfirim Shoyagim Latolef. The Kfirim, the lions, are calling out for food. So the Eibishter heard his Kfilis. Nechisu Le Tavta Atmoso. And two pieces of meat came down from Shamayim. Chodo Achluha, Vechodo Shavkuha. They ate one piece, and they left the other one. I say, Ba'os Elebein Midrosha. So Rabbi Shimon ben Chalakta took this piece of meat, he salvaged this piece of meat, and he came to Beis Medrash. And he asked them, Boy Allah, Dovot Tomei Huzer or Dovot Tahoev? Is this Tomei? Or is it Tahoev? Is it Mutter? Or is it also? So they said to him, Ein Dovot Tomei Yored Min HaShamayim. Nothing Tomei comes from Shamayim. So it's kosher. Then the Gemara continues, and the Gemara says, Boy Reb Zera, Mer Bavahu, Yodol Edmus Chamoyer Mahu. What happens if something comes down, and it seems self-evident that it's not kosher? It looks like a chamoyer, it looks like a donkey. Is that also going to be kosher? Omalei, so he said to him, Yorud Nala, which is an insulting expression, to say, you don't know what you're talking about. Omalei, we've already said that a Dovot Tomei does not come down from Shamayim. So they ask Akash on this Gemara, why does he answer him, Ein Dovot Tomei Yored Min HaShamayim? Why don't they simply say that something which comes from Shamayim is not Bosa? Why don't they just simply say it's not Bosa? So if they infer from here, the possibly infer from here, that really it is Bosa. It's just that Dovot Tomei is not Yored Min HaShamayim, but it is actually Bosa, even though it doesn't come from an animal, and it has all the criteria and all the halachas of Bosa. You won't be able to eat this Bosa with Cholov, you won't be able to, and whatever the halachas of Bosa are, the same thing will apply to this meat as well. I'm sorry? A piece of meat. How do you shut the piece of meat? I'm sorry? Sorry, well, a piece of meat doesn't have a collar and a vesha. How can you shut the piece of meat? Well, that's a good question, because the Pasuk discusses that even if lab-grown meat is meat, but every meat has to have a heter through shchita. And this lab-grown meat hasn't had a heter through shchita. So how can you eat it, even if it is basar, and even if it does come from a kosher animal rather from a non-kosher animal? And even if it comes from a kosher animal which was shechted, but who says that shchita would apply to this piece of meat?
How did they know that the
Basar
came from Shemayim?
How did
Shemayim know? He assumed,
he knew it came from Shemayim.
Basar Shem Salam Menayim,
he didn't go to that. But it could be even before the Kol of Basar Shem Salam Menayim. That's the concern.
Then the food doesn't have to be shafted because the mother was shafted.
Right. Is this the same with Ben Pekua?
That's my question.
Possibly, possibly not. You can see both sides of that, right? So now let's see. Is this a comparison to lab-grown meat or not? You could say it's the same thing. Just like this meat did not, was not extracted, it wasn't derived from an animal, so too, lab-grown meat doesn't come from an animal, so it's just as kosher as the meat in the story.
Where are the cells from?
That's correct. I forgot to mention that the cells can come, on a practical level, it can come from an animal that's still alive, which would tell us there's a problem with human eye. It can come from an animal which is not yet shechted as well, so you have a problem of shkita. It can come from an animal which is bechal, not even a mean which is kosher. And it could come from a meat which is kosher. What exactly is required? That's the question that the Poskim speak about. Yotzei Matomei. Is it a regular Yotzei or not?
Yeah.
Right. Or is it a new entity? It's not Yotzei. Maybe Yotzei is when it's Yotzei, but it's a new entity.
Well,
it's Yotzei Matomei. And one of the arguments against that is that these cells are not Nur al-Ayin. You can't see them. What halacha does it have if you can't see anything? And we're going to talk about that in Mitzvah Shem, if there's time. The cells themselves do not look like meat. It's a very strong argument. They do not look like meat. They don't look like anything because you can't see them. And if you can't see them, why should it have any status whatsoever in halacha?
It's a plural potential cell. It could be going to anything. It has the DNA, like
why would it be different to a lion, which are not physically possible to see? Okay, that's very good. We'll talk about that, I hope. So the question now is, can we draw any proof from this Gemara or not? Can we say, just like the meat which comes min hashamayim is not called meat, is called meat rather, so too, meat which is grown in a lab from cells is also called meat. You don't care what the history or where the meat was sourced from, that's irrelevant. What's relevant is, what is it now, what does it look like? So that's possibly a raya that this meat is meat, just like that the lab-grown meat is meat, just like this meat in the Gemara. Alternatively, we could say, not there's a very big difference, a very fundamental difference, sorry?
Maybe there's a finished product. The meat that came down from Shemayim came as a finished product. Was it evolved into it?
And therefore,
what's different than this kind of
thing? What you might be saying is what I was planning to say. Let's see, let's try it. What I was thinking of saying is that there's a huge difference between the meat which comes from the Shamayim, which essentially, all meat comes from the Shamayim. All meat was created by the Creator, right? There's only one difference. Sometimes it comes through a medium called a Baal Chai, a cow, and sometimes it doesn't. It comes directly from the Shamayim. In all cases, meat is meat. Whereas, if it's grown in our lab, we're mimicking meat. We're not creating meat. We can't create anything, right? We can mimic something. So this is just mimicked meat, so maybe it doesn't have a halacha of basar. So anyway, you don't have a life, it's not. That's what you meant. Does it need melicha? It's another one of the questions. That's an excellent question.
No.
Who says it has gum in it?
Oh,
well, if there are only... Let me ask you a question. Let's say, if they take cells, meat cells only, and have isolated meat cells from blood cells, and they only use meat cells, put them in the bioreactor, and produce a piece of meat, would it be dumb in there? Probably not. Right? The question is, can that really be done? Can you? That's one of the problems that they're having. That's one of the problems. Right. A lot of the flavor in a good steak comes from... Right, right. Correct. There's another moment, strikingly similar. Boy Reb Zeiner, interestingly, Reb Zeiner was mentioned in the first video as well. Boy Reb Zeiner, chitin cheyorde ba'ovim, chitin, wheat, which comes down from the clouds. Mahu, what's the halacha? So what's chitin cheyorde ba'ovim? Where do you have chitin coming down from the clouds? So Rashi says, yorde ba'ovim im hamotor, it comes down together with the dew. Says Rashi that the clouds drew up water, moisture from the ocean, from the Okeanos. So together with that, it also absorbed the chitim, which were in a boat in the ocean. And now it's dropping it down again. So the Gemara says, Lemai, what kind of question are you asking? What do I want to use these chitim for? So the Gemara says, Ilma Nochas, if you want to use it to make a problem mincha, amayloi, why not? Chitim is chitim, who cares? Elo, the Shtei Halechem. So the Gemara says, maybe we have a problem. Can you use it for Shtei Halechem? Why would Shtei Halechem be different? So the Gemara says, Min Moshvei Seichem Amar Lachmon. The Torah says, you can only take Chitim for Shtei Halechem, Min Moshvei Seichem, from where you dwell, from Eretz Yisroel. La'afukei b'chutz la'aretz, you can't use it if it comes from chutz la'aretz. So the Gemara says, maybe, so Ovim Shapir Domi. So you can use Chitim which comes from the clouds, because it's not chutz la'aretz. It's okay, it's called Moshvei, it's not called chutz la'aretz. Or you don't, Min Moshvei Seichem Dafkin, maybe Dafkin from Eretz Yisroel, la'afilu de Ovim Nami Noi. And that would exclude Ovim as well. So this would be totally irrelevant to our conversation. So Tosfos says, Tosfos brings Rashi, and Tosfos asks, that Rabbeinu Tam says he doesn't understand what Rashi is talking about. If these chitim originated in Chutz La'aretz, so why would it become mutar for Shtei Halechem just because it went through the clouds? V'i, me'eretz Yisrael, and if they originated in Eretz Yisrael, so why would it become also just because it went to Chutz La'aretz or went onto a boat out in the ocean? So Tosfos says he can't accept Rashi's pshat. So Tosfos says, you know what the pshat is? Here we're talking about a case where the chitim, the wheat, came down from the clouds, alideines. And Tosfos says, ki hanu ach mahosa b'perek revit daladusis. Just like the Gemara in Sanhedrin we just discussed. So here we have another Gemara. The Gemara says an identical shayla according to Tosfos, but instead of using meat as an example, the Gemara is using chitim. So we have these chitim, and we don't know whether the chitim which came on the dinas can be used for shtei halechem or not. It has to be mimash v'yisechem, and this is not mimash v'yisechem. So it's mashma. If not for the problem of mimash v'yisechem, it would be kosher for shtei halechem. Why? Because it has the status of chitim. Chitim is chitim. Baso is baso. But again, we can draw a distinction between chitim which came in Hashemayim and chitim which is developed in a lab. Again, because we can only mimic the creation. We can't create it. And if we don't actually create it, it doesn't have a shein chitim. And so maybe these will not be good rayas. Another interesting sugya is discussed, and that is the famous kasha that the Achronim has about Hanukkah. How could have used in the base of Mikdash the shemen in the menorah, the shemen in the menorah that they found, according to the Gemara, was shemen nes, came as a nes. So shemen nes, they say, is not shemen zayis. And if it's not shemen zayis, how could they use it? So some of the postulates say that the obvious answer to that kasha is that we don't care where it was derived from. It's irrelevant what the source of the shemen is. Shemen is shemen, just like basar is basar, chitim is chitim, shemen is shemen. So now that I have shemen, even if it came on the day nes, it's still kosher. But it's not so posh that would tell us. Because in the case of Shemen, for the Beis HaMikdosh, it says in the Pasuk, in Tetzaveh, in Shemen Zayis Kosis Lamo'er. Shemen Zayis means Shemen which is sourced from Zayis. Kosis means it was crushed. The Torah is not just giving you a recipe or teaching us how to make Shemen. The Torah is actually telling us a tonight in the Shemen that you have to use for the Menorah. The Shemen used for the Menorah must be derived, extracted from a Zayis, and it must be crushed, Kosis. It's not just a description, but it's actually telling you the halacha of where the shemen must come from. And since the Torah is telling us the halacha of where the shemen must come from, so it's a very different shayla. When the poskim are asking, how can you use shemen nes for shemen for the menorah? They're not asking whether it is or it isn't shemen. What they're asking is that the Torah is specifically asking us to use shemen which was extracted from Azayis and was crushed. And that, because shemen nes, you don't have. I'll be brief. I want to move on to a different subject regarding lab-grown meat. And that is something which was touched on before by a number of you, about something which is so small, so microscopic, doesn't have any halachic status or not. And there's quite a fascinating Rashi in Eruvin, Daf Chof Ches. Rashi over there tells us the source of the word sheretz. Where does this word come from, sheretz? It says Rashi, sheretz loshen sheretz, it ran. Dovah shuhu not ba'aretz, something which moves around on the ground. Ve'einai nira, you can't see it. Elo al yedei shirutzoi v'rechushoi. The only way you can see it, the only way you can discern that this thing is here, is because you see its movement. But otherwise, just by looking at it, says Rashi, you wouldn't know that it exists. Mipnei koitnoi, because it's so small. So I think we see from Rashi that a sheretz, the definition of a sheretz, is something which can be recognized through its movement. But otherwise, you wouldn't even know that it's there. It doesn't even have a shame of a sheretz. If it's so small that you can't see it, says Rashi, it doesn't have a shame of a sheretz. And the same is true of every small item, all microscopic matter. It doesn't have a shame, not of basal, not of chitin, not of anything. If it's so small that you can't see it, and you can't even recognize its movement, it doesn't have a name of anything, and it's non-existent in halacha. There's several ways to understand why something which is so small doesn't have any status. It could be, as we say, it doesn't have a shame of an item. It's non-existent in halacha. It could be because it's so small, it doesn't have a shear. In other words, of course, let's say that the sheretz is called a sheretz when it's very small. But just like, as a loose example, there's a man ba'omer in the Gemara that says, chatzi shear is mutter min ha-Torah. If there's an iser on a kazayis, so the Torah says a kazayis is also. A chatzi zayis will be mutter. But even if we hold chatzi shear is also min ha-Torah, that doesn't mean to say that there's no cutoff point. There could still be a cutoff point, something which is not nira le'inayim, something which can't be seen, will be mutter. Because it doesn't have a shear. That doesn't necessarily mean to say it doesn't have a shame of a sheretz, or it doesn't have a shame of bosa on the veda, or whatever it might be. It could be an izel veda, but it's not also, because it's pachas mikashir. And thirdly, there's a possible svara that the reason that something which is not visible is mutter is because, simply because it's not chashiv. Something to have an izel, it has to have a chashivis. And if it doesn't have chashivis, it will not be awesome. And let me just mention to you a couple of the lashonis. I'll read to you from Moshe Feinstein and from Shlomo Zalman, and we'll see maybe there's some indication as to how they felt about this. Rav Moshe's Lashon is, and he speaks about the loyim which can only see with the aid of a microscope. And so he says, "Mipnei shehatorah loy osra elo toloyim ushtotzim urmosim sheniru le'inayim." And then he quotes this b'shem Reb Chaim, Reb Chaim Brisker. So he says that the Torah never asked something which is not nira le'inayim. That sounds very much like the svar that we said before, that even though it may have a shem of a sheretz, the Torah didn't ask it. That's one Lashon. And then there's a svar of Rav Shlomo Zalman, where Rav Shlomo Zalman already then in his time was already discussing genetic engineering, and he discusses whether these tiny items, these tiny microscopic cells, whether they have any dinim or not. And he says, "Kevin she'anoshim metaplim b'chalkikim ha'ele, since people are dealing and handling with these chalkikim, these tiny microscopic particles, u'ma'avirim oisom minin echod l'sheni, and they are transferring them from one thing to another, harei ze chashiv mamash kenir le'einayim." He says, Rav Shlomo Zalman, it's considered nir le'einayim. And it's nothing, you can't compare that to toloim which are not visible, because this is something which they're dealing with, and they're being machshavit. This Shlomo Zalman doesn't bring the Rashi in Eruvin, but it seems that he's referring to that Rashi and saying, don't learn from that Rashi that something which is not nirel einayim is automatically going to be mutter. No, that's what it says Shlomo Zalman is, like chashivas, it moves around, so I can't ignore it. And so too over here, where I'm dealing with this, and I'm using them, it gives it a chashivas, and in Mela, I've got to take it into account and give it dinim and halachas. As I say, this is not chashivat lahalach al-maisa. The custom around the world deal with this shayla, whether these cells can be taken from a veda, whether it has to be taken from a kosher meat, a behemah, which is already geshochten, and so on, and the shayla, if it has a status of meat, so it should be able to be cooked, shouldn't be able to be cooked with milk or not. But I'm telling you, it's just a matter of time until this item comes to the shelves in the supermarkets, and it'll be there. From what I understand, it will have an OU, am I right? It will have an OU. I'm sorry? OU meat, it will be flaky. Right? And Rakupanin, this year is just for the purpose of introducing the sugya to the oil.
You have been listening to a presentation of BensTorah.com.